where projects involving large-scale medical equipment or artificial intelligence are the areas where the foreign companies have an edge over the local businesses. Cost being the major factor, the competition in majority of sectors is with ASEAN countries or China. As per the agreement, procurement has been open to UAE companies in 34 central government ministries, including Ministry of Economic Affairs, New and Renewable Energy, Power, etc.
Allowing access to the UAE to procure government tenders has resulted in the opening of the floodgates to similar demands from other countries India is negotiating with. These include the European Union, the UK and Australia. The agreement with the UAE is being used as a benchmark by other negotiating countries. Additionally, countries with which India already has FTAs may push for including access to $500 billion Indian government procurement market in the agreements.
In a surprising move, India and the European Union resumed negotiations in June 2022 for a free trade agreement after almost a decade. EU's demands include inclusion of concessions extended to other FTA partners, namely UAE, along with duty cuts on automobiles, dairy products. India also has ongoing talks with the UK, Australia, and Canada. All these countries are eyeing the Indian central government procurement market. According to the Indian government officials, the UK and EU will not negotiate if the public procurement market is kept out of the trade talks. Australia has also been asking for similar access as given to the UAE.
Well, I think it's very difficult to ever conceive of a situation that has large corporations facing a threat from smaller, more efficient companies. I don't think the business sector, the private sector works that way. The way corporatism works basically is huge corporations come into a country, whether it's by making promises or through corrupt payments or whatever it takes, and initially perform in order to be able to say, look, we're delivering a better product at a lower price, which helps everybody, including consumers. But once they've established themselves, they're like a caterpillar or a moth. They metamorphosize into something horrible that destroys all other possibilities, including local smaller businesses. It's very difficult for small businesses to survive, let alone threaten the supremacy of big corporations in a place where corporations have been allowed to come in and basically dominate the roost. So I don't see there being a scenario once these multinational corporations start coming in and doing trade with India, which understandably is primarily concerned about its own economic interests, that sees ordinary small businesses and medium-sized businesses and domestic businesses and individuals protected from what's going to play out. This is all part of the grander scheme for U.S. hegemony, or if you like, Atlantic world hegemony, where everybody's dancing to a set of rules that's drafted in America.
According to the experts, if a national treatment clause is included in the FTAs, it would mean similar treatment to foreign small companies. Given that foreign micro, small, and medium enterprises are very strong, it would create stiff competition for their domestic counterparts. The economists regard this as the real cause of concern, as providing a particular area means agreement to give access to other areas. Public procurement, being a huge market, is always preferred. In both scenarios, Indian businesses face danger of foreign entities entering the domestic market and increasing competition.
So we have discussed public procurement as part of free trade agreements of India with different countries. Now, let's switch to social media and see what people around the world had to say on this issue.
Let's now take a look at what the global media has to say about it. Mark Warner tweeted, "Public procurement of contracts worth over 200 crore rupees were opened up in the FTA signed with the UAE last year, and now every country India is negotiating with, including the EU, UK and Australia, is gunning for access to the public procurement market." J. John G. Murphy, an economic expert, wrote, UK expects to strike FTA with India and accede to TPP in 2023, reports Bloomberg. The administration's view that FTAs are passé is a lonely one. Shantanu Singh, an economist, tweeted, people aware of the development said that Indian companies, especially those in the IT sector, have also sought access to the public procurement market in the EU and the UK. Mint, a news portal, wrote, the inclusion of public procurement in the UAE agreement marked a first for India, which has been notoriously shy of opening up this lucrative market to foreign companies.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Contrary to the claims of the Modi-led BJP government, the intensity of attacks on the civilian population in Jammu and Kashmir has increased in recent years. These attacks have mainly been aimed on the minority Kashmiri Pandit community and the non-resident Hindus living in Kashmir. Experts say that the armed group's strategy to attack the non-locals and minorities is a way to signal opposition to the means employed by the Bharatiya Janata Party to change the demography of the Muslim-majority region.
With the start of the new year, the state of Jammu and Kashmir witnessed the killing of four civilians in the Rajouri district by unidentified gunmen. Two more people, including a child, died the following day when a blast rocked the area. Conflicting with the return of normalcy as claimed by the BJP government, at least 18 non-local Hindus and Kashmiri Pandits have been killed since the abrogation of Article 370. According to the data provided by the government of India, the violence has seen no downward trend since the revocation of the statehood in the year 2019. The Modi-led BJP government had cited the special status of Jammu and Kashmir as the primary reason for violence. 229 armed attacks were recorded in the year 2021, leading to 40 civilian killings. The number went to 30 civilian killings in the year 2022. In the years 2017 and 2016, 279 and 322 attacks were reported, thus showing no significant improvement in the situation, as wrongly portrayed by New Delhi. The central BJP government has been asserting that the abrogation of Article 370 brought normalcy to the violence-ridden region. However, the opposite appears to be true. In the year 2013, prior to Modi's coming to power, only 170 cases of violence were reported from the Himalayan region.
Contrary to the popular belief that the COVID-19 pandemic has wreaked havoc to the economy of Jammu and Kashmir, statistics show a different picture. After the abrogation of Article 370, the investments in the region dropped from $72.3 million in 2018-2019 to $36.3 million in the year 2019-2020. According to the government of India's recent figures, the investment has decreased by more than 50% since the revocation of the special status of the Himalayan region.
The claim that the abrogation of the semi-autonomous status of the state will lead to economic development in the region has failed on the ground. Last year in December, India's Minister of State for Home Affairs, Nityanand Rai, gave figures about the economic status of Jammu and Kashmir. According to the statistics, the investments in the region have fallen by 55% in the past 4 years. Previously blaming the local governments for the economic backwardness in the region, the BJP government in New Delhi has not been able to put the Union Territory directly ruled by the center on the road to economic development as had been promised earlier. According to the data published by the Indian Ministry of Home Affairs, the total investment in the year 2017 to 2018 was $102.8 million, considerably decreasing to $50.5 million in the year 2019 to 2022. And in 2021 to 2022, the investments were recorded to be $46 million, thus laying bare the false claims of economic growth in the region. Earlier, Modi-led BJP government would cite restrictions on the procurement of land as the main reason for economic backwardness of the Himalayan region. However, after the abrogation of Article 370, the government still has not been able to bring private sector investment to the state, thus ruining the economy further.
Now, to have more insight on this, we are joined by Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the Managing Director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, contrary to the rosy picture painted by the BJP government, the civilian killings of the non-resident Hindus and Kashmir Pandits have increased. So the question is, do you think the armed groups have changed their tactics after the abrogation of Article 370?
First of all, we all should condemn the killing of civilian for whatever pretext somebody is doing this. Nobody can justify killings of civilians by any means, whether they are Pandits or non-Kashmiri residents or whoever. Having said this, that I think that the civilian Pandits, Kashmiri Pandits, or the non-resident Kashmiris are being made cannon fodder by the Indian government. Indian government has a plan to change the demography of occupied state of Jammu and Kashmir. For that, they are bringing in non-Kashmiris in the state of Jammu and Kashmir. And they have changed not just the state of the disputed state, but also they have changed the laws about the domiciles and the residence. So that has enabled them to bring non-resident Kashmiris. And by doing this, actually the BJP government is fueling tension between different religions. So because the demographic changes being made in Kashmir are based on the religion, because predominantly Kashmir is a Muslim majority state, and which should have been something India could have taken pride in that, that it has a state which is majority Muslim state, and that suited Indian claim of secularism. But since the BJP is in power, which is a Hindu fascist and nationalist government, they are trying to change the demography on the basis of Hindu Muslims. So they are bringing in more Hindus, and which are actually creating troubles for the Hindu Pandits, which are Kashmiris and very much state subject. They lived there for centuries, and they used to have very cordial relations with the Muslim majority of the state of Jammu and Kashmir. But now they are also in trouble because of these political policies of BJP, which I think which will not only backfire within Kashmir, but elsewhere in India as well.
Now, Mr. Khan, citing the special status as a roadblock to the economic development of the region, statistics show that investments in the region have fallen by 55%. Now, conflicting with the claims, has the withdrawal of the special status been responsible for the decrease in economic investments?
Hey, you know, this is very interesting that the BJP says that after abrogation of special status to Kashmir, they will bring in investment, while destroying the economy of Kashmiri traders and Kashmiri businessmen for almost now 10 years, consistently destroying the local economy. How can you actually improve the economic condition of the state, the people of the state? This is, I think, not understandable to common sense, that local economy, you know, the blockade of the Kashmiri traders, it remained for months. And the Kashmir is practically in siege for almost 2 years now, and 2.5 years now. And you claim that you will bring investment, and that is not possible. And as you mentioned, the statistics have shown that it is not possible. Actually, it is hypocrisy at its best. Whatever the BJP government is trying to do in Kashmir is actually to strengthen its occupation. And for that, their sole objective is to weaken the will of the local people by whatever means. And they are trying to bring in, as I earlier mentioned, non-resident people. And now they are trying to bring in the business community of India into Kashmir while depriving the local businessmen of their own businesses. This is ridiculous. You cannot actually prosper as a state or a territory while the local people are deprived of their basic livelihoods, and you are bringing in other investors. That's not possible. And this is the this is the basic objective the Modi had presented Kashmir as a business hub for non-resident business community to come in and to benefit from the tourism and other businesses available in Kashmir. And the sole objective is actually to destroy the local businesses. Now, I think that will not work. Whatever India try, that will not work for India and not for the people of the Kashmir.
Mr. Khan, we've seen that violence in the region has not improved in the past few years, as claimed by the BJP government. So has the center's iron fist policy turned counterproductive in the Himalayan region?
History is a teacher, but we tend not to listen from it, not to learn from it. Everybody knows that you cannot crush the will of the people by iron fist or whatever strict policies you adopt. This is not for the first time India is adopting very strict policies. India killed more than 100,000 people in Kashmir, but the Kashmiri people never, ever, bore down in front of Indian pressure. They still demand their right of self-determination, and this is the will of the people. You know, whatever India uses sometimes stick, sometimes carrot policy for the people of Kashmir. Sometimes they try to appease them, sometimes they try to coerce them. But both have failed in the past and both will fail in the past, in future as well, because the people of Jammu and Kashmir want to have their right of self-determination. And India should actually give them the opportunity to exercise their right, which India itself had committed under the UN Security Council resolutions. And it was basically India which took Kashmir issue into United Nations, not Pakistan. India was losing the war at that time because the Kashmiri people had taken up arms, and this Azad Kashmir and Gilgit-Baltistan, that was liberated by the people. And India was fearful that Srinagar was about to fall, and when India took that to UN Security Council, now India is obliged to fulfill its own commitments at international forums, which India is denying and which will cost India miserably in the future.
Now, Mr. Khan, last but not least, the incidence of violence in Kashmir has seen a downward trend before Modi's coming to power. So the question is, has the anti-Muslim policy of the BJP further alienated the people of the region and pushed them to the wall?
Actually, if we see the violence of the Kashmiri militant groups against the Indian state, that is irrespective of who is in power in the center, whether it is BJP, whether it is Congress, whether it is a united front of different political parties. The Kashmiri people are actually resistant against the occupation of India, and they want to exercise their right of self-determination, which was deprived by India. So the basic thing is that the militant groups, they will carry their work, whether it is BJP, whether it is some other government. But having said that, the strict policies which in BJP has applied on Kashmir, it actually help the militant groups to recruit more and more Kashmiri youth. there was a time that then there was a mix of non-Kashmiri and Kashmiri militants. Now we are seeing that majority of the militants operating in Kashmir are purely the Kashmiri youth. So that is a phenomena which changed during the BJP's government, that more youth is being radicalized in Kashmir and they are joining different militant groups. And this is for the first time in the history of Kashmir that that during BJP's government, we have seen the presence of Daesh in Kashmir and we have seen presence of Al-Qaeda in Kashmir. It never happened. So that is the level of, suppression and depression among the Kashmiri youth, which can actually become catastrophic for India and for the region as well. So that is something which is new in Kashmir, and that is the result of the BJP's policies.
There you have it, Mr. Abdullah Khan from Islamabad. He's the managing director of Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies. Thank you for being on the program, sir. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sharp Media Network tweeted, "No developments in Indian illegally occupied Jammu and Kashmir during last 4 years. The last 4 years have ruined the entire economy of Jammu and Kashmir, which has in reality collapsed. Unemployment is at its peak and youth is in utter frustration." Frontier Indica wrote, "It's no secret that under Modi, the security situation in Punjab has gotten much worse, and the benefits of revocation of Article 370 vis-a-vis the safety of common people in J&K, especially KPs, have also been short-lived." The Wire, a prominent news portal, tweeted, "The people of Kashmir say silence, fear, rising prices, and unemployment have taken over the region after August 5, 2019. Jammu-based reserve category employee working in Kashmir tweeted, "Situation in Kashmir is not yet conducive, but still being forced to resume duties. I don't know why. We are not with any Z security and weapon to defend ourselves, still forced by stopping salaries. Our life is also valuable to our old parents, if yours matters to your parents."
And that was our episode about the FTA's public procurement and the apprehensions of Indian business houses, and also the worrying economic and security situation in Jammu and Kashmir. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. Stay tuned.
باید بخواهیم، شرط اول خواستنه.
The first condition in order to be nurtured spiritually is the wish inside our heart. It is exactly like enrolling our child in the best private school with the best property so that he or she may study the lessons in the best way possible. However, if our child does not have the wish inside his or her heart, all the expensive facilities won't work properly in this regard. Examples given in the Holy Quran are really beautiful in this regard. In Ayah 11 of Surah Tahrim, we read, Allah cites an example of the faithful, the wife of Pharaoh, when she said, My Lord, build me a home near you in paradise, and deliver me from Pharaoh and his conduct, and deliver me from the wrongdoing Lot. From this example, we understand that the palace of Pharaoh was not a good place for divine nurturing. However, a strong will of Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, was the ground for establishing monotheism. She was so strong that she became one of the best role models for the faithful. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulema's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Mandegari. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. In the limelight.
The U.S. oil and gas industry spent $124.4 million lobbying amid record profits in 2022. The industry targeted rules governing methane emissions as well as oil and gas development on federal lands and waters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, the U.S. oil and gas industry spent about $124.4 million lobbying the federal government in 2022, according to an Open Secrets analysis of lobbying disclosures. The industry's 2022 lobbying spending is a nominal increase from 2021, but down slightly from adjusted for inflation. Industry-wide spending on lobbying dipped during the COVID-19 pandemic, but increased gradually as fossil fuel companies sought to influence federal action on climate change. Lobbying disclosures indicate the industry targeted a range of issues that will impact oil and gas companies as the global economy weans itself off fossil fuels, including rules governing methane emissions, oil and gas development on federal land and waters, and subsidies for carbon capture technology. Koch Industries, the country's second largest privately held company, also spent about $11.3 million, more than any other oil and gas company. Half a dozen other fossil fuel corporations, including Occidental Petroleum, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and Chevron Corp., spent another $44.3 million on lobbying. In addition to being among the industry's top lobbying spenders, Occidental Petroleum, Chevron, and ExxonMobil were also among the top emitters of methane and other greenhouse gases in the U.S. in 2022, according to a Cirrus and Clean Air Task Force report. As Russia-Ukraine crisis transformed the global fossil fuel supply chain, driving oil and gas prices to unprecedented levels, the industry's top lobbying spenders reported record annual profits. Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Exxon, and Shell saw a combined $1 trillion in sales in 2022, 15% of which were profits. In June last year, Democratic President Joe Biden singled out Exxon, which reported a record $55 billion in profits for making more money than God. Industry groups also topped the list of 2022 lobbying spenders. The American Petroleum Institute, which represents nearly 600 oil and gas companies, spent about $4.4 million on federal lobbying. The American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers spent about $3.8 million. The combined lobbying, political contribution, and advertising efforts of trade groups opposed to climate change legislations outspent climate advocacy groups by 27-1 between 2008 and 2018, a recent Pennsylvania Capital Star analysis found. These groups have historically contributed to GOP candidates and political committees, with the trend continuing during 2022 cycle. Chevron told Open Secrets, "Our goal is to help shape effective, responsible, and nonpartisan U.S. energy policy in what they said is an effort to deliver affordable, reliable, and ever cleaner energy." The American Petroleum Institute said they regularly engage with a broad range of stakeholders on the critical role U.S. natural gas and oil can play in providing affordable, reliable energy to meet growing global demand while advancing a lower carbon future. Other top industry lobbies, corporations, and groups did not respond to a request for a comment. Last year's most lobbied congressional bill by the oil and gas industry and all other industries was the Inflation Reduction Act of 2022, the nation's largest climate spending package ever. The landmark bill, which Biden signed into law on August 16, 2022, directs billions of dollars, including tax incentives, into clean energy technology in an effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The Department of Energy posits that the provisions of this bill combined with the bipartisan infrastructure law of 2021 could reduce emissions by approximately a gigaton. But several provisions in the law also address some of the fossil fuel industry's top priorities. The Inflation Reduction Act requires the federal government to auction offshore leases to oil and gas companies before issuing permits to offshore wind and solar projects. The trade-off was incorporated into law as part of Senate Democratic leadership's deal with Joe Manchin, a swing vote in the Senate. Manchin received over $950,000 from the oil and gas industry over the past 5 years, according to Open Secrets records, and has ties to a family coal business. Oil and gas companies also lobbied for regulatory approval of specific larger-scale projects, which can take years to move forward. ConocoPhillips spent almost $8.7 lobbying the federal government in 2022, up from $4.4 million in 2021, and more than it spent on lobbying in any other year since 2011. Among the issues mentioned in lobbying disclosures was Willow, the company's massive project to extract oil from the federally administered National Petroleum Reserve in the Alaskan Arctic. Environmental groups have urged Biden to block that development permanently, arguing that the project will commit the U.S. to 30 years of fossil fuel extraction and undermine the president's climate agenda. The website of oil price also noted when adjusted for inflation, the oil and gas industries spent on lobbying the federal government last year dipped slightly. In actual terms, oil and gas industry spent $124.4 million on federal lobbying, according to an Open Secret analysis that was released recently. Of that $124.4 million, Koch Industries spent $11.29 million, more than any other oil and gas industry, the records show. In real terms, 2022 spend is up slightly from 2021, but 2021 lobbying spend was still depressed from the COVID-19 pandemic.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is Zainab, and today we're going to discuss something very important with Professor Naqavi. Professor Naqavi is a faculty member at Al-Mustafa University. Dear listeners, in this program, we try to answer your questions and issues that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified progeny. Well, Professor Naqavi, assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Well, Professor, you know, there are many adults, I must say, some are even just young, who are in the early 20s or in the mid-20s, who I have often heard actually talking a lot about their parents, actually bashing behind their back and saying that it was their mistake. They should have gone this way, they should have gone that way. They should have been doing this for me, but my parents failed here to do this kind of thing for me. So if they had done this particular effort, I was not this today. So these are all expectations that children have from their parents. Which expectations are right and how long? Because once you are a responsible person, should you still be expecting from your parents?
Now, certainly if our parents did not take care of their responsibilities in the way that Islam wanted them to do so, that is, of course, something which is which will be, and they will be answerable for that. But now, me as a person who has grown up and I have realized that these problems exist within me. Whatever the cause may be, it was because of improper upbringing. That has gone by. That is past now. That is past history. I can't do anything about it. So I need to change myself. If I know what the proper thing to do is, then I should change myself. Now that I've realized, if I'm saying that my parents made a mistake, so it means that now I realize that it was a mistake. So now that I understand that it was a mistake, I need to now rectify it.
All right.
So now the onus is on me now. The honest, whatever was there upon my parents, it was till the time I attained the age of puberty or the age of adolescence. That was where their responsibility stopped.
All right.
The moment I became a responsible person, an answerable person, that is where I should have started behaving properly. Now, to some extent, I can blame my parents, but from a certain time onwards, I become responsible for my own self, my own actions. So now, if I've made mistakes, then I should start rectifying them. For example, I should have been praying from the time I was an adolescent. I did not pray. Whatever the reason was, my parents did not, God forbid, pray, but I should have been praying. Now that I know, then I should now come back and go for the qaza prayers. If I did not take care of the of my financial responsibilities towards Islam, the religious dues, I should take care of them. If I did not treat my family properly, I should start treating them properly. So now I have to rectify that. Yes, the expectations from my parents were can only be limited and confined till the time I was not an adult myself.
All right.
So. And by blaming them, I'm not going to achieve anything. And rather, I should
work hard upon things.
Despite the fact that I feel that they wronged me, but I should behave. This was bilwalidaini ihsana. Behaving properly and nicely and in a good manner with our parents is not confined to the time when they treated me.
Allah is not giving a condition with this word.
It's mutlaq. It's general. It's not just to confined to the situation where they treated me with ihsan, so I should treat them with ihsan. No, it is general. And it covers even the situation, because we have so many ahadith when it talks about when the person comes, my mother or my father is not a Muslim.
Yeah. Our professor will discuss more on this after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naghavi. Professor Naghavi, there are so many people around. For example, I may remember someone in his late 30s who married in his late 30s. And of course, he did it with his own money. But he was continuously actually blaming his father and others because they were not the ones who could invest on time. So do you think late 30s is a good age to be expecting still from your parents?
Of course, at the age of 30, one should become independent and should struggle for himself and try to earn his own living if that is the case. He should not expect from his parents. But of course, as far as the Islamic ruling goes there, that if one of them, either the parents or the child, the son, is not capable of managing his own finances, then it is the responsibility of the other person to take care of. If the parents are poor and
then
needy.
But the question here is for how long? For example, if there's a person in his 30s and he's still mismanaged, he's not able to earn for himself, he's not able to actually decide things for himself, he's not able to decide where the life is taking him, is it still the responsibility of his parents to take care of his needs?
Of course, if he is poor and in need and he cannot make a living of himself or for himself, then they should be able to sustain his life, sustain him, give him help him with the basic necessities of life. That is a responsibility.
But some parents actually stop over here with the thinking that my help could make him more lazy.
No, it can be conditioned.
All right.
You need to,
So you can actually help and sustain with conditions.
I mean, there should be a limit to it. But again, if a person is qualified as a faqir, as a person who is poor, is in need, and that is qualified and defined by the fact that a person does not have enough to make a year's living. Maybe he does not have a job which would guarantee him a year-long living, or he does not have enough capital to invest, or he does not have enough resources to make an earning, and he does not have an amount to sustain him for a year. He is considered to be a poor person in the view of Islamic Sharia. And a poor person is eligible to receive from the Baytul Mal.
All right.
But, for example, the Baytul Mal is not giving him the resources with the government are not enough. They're not giving him. Then if the father has enough resources, then he has to support his child. And he cannot give religious dues to his son.
Yeah.
And vice versa is also correct.
All right. We'll discuss more on this topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm Zainab with Professor Naghavi, and Professor Naghavi is discussing something very important. Professor, you said that a child, when he grows adult, he should not be expecting much from his parents, but while something, even if his parents went somewhere wrong in the upbringing process, he should not be blaming now as he's adult now. He should be actually managing things, and he should actually be able
he should
to
be trying to maintain to earn a living. He should not remain at home. He should not become a lazy person. He should not desist from lethargic activities or activities which are not fruitful. He should take advice and pay heed to the advice of people who are learned in this field. But till that time, is able to stand up on his feet, and he's able to make a living for himself and his family. Maybe he has a family. He has to take care of the family. So they're not at fault, are they? So in that case, if a father has enough resources, then it is his responsibility to take care of that
All
situation
right.
and help him out and assist him and provide him enough to sustain himself. But with the condition that he perseveres and he strives to reach a condition where he becomes a bread earner himself.
All right.
So, of course, the responsibility, legal responsibility, shari'i responsibility is there, but also, again, to an extent which makes him independent.
All right.
And that is the case with any poor person. We should be doing that.
All right. So do you think when this adult, when he grows up and starts blaming his parents, all right, my parents did not go well with me here, they should have brought me this way or that way, they should have taken care of this thing they did not take care of. Don't you think we as adults, when we start thinking this and blaming our parents, don't you think we actually ignored their conditions? Maybe they were not in a situation. Maybe they were not much educated. Maybe, like today, we have Islamic upbringing show and they did not have that time to get more educated and more learned.
Certainly. Now, shifting the blame to them, as I said, is not going to help him. If he's wasting his time doing this and always thinking about this, he can utilize that time for doing something positive and do something which will make him a bread earner, which will make him do things and think of things out of the box, maybe. And today technology is there, so much of technology is there, which is teaching us how to make an earning even by sitting at home. So we can earn even if we sit at home today. After the spell of corona that we had, mankind had for a few years, mankind developed and then started to earn while sitting at home. So this is a development which today our future generations, our children can learn from. And there are so many avenues opening up. So we need to learn things according to the changing times. And we can become bread earners sitting at home even. But if we start shifting the blame and thinking about this all the time, then how are we going to carry out positive activities?
All right, so that your suggestion is that the time you're taking to blame others, especially your parents, spend that time in some creativity, in some construction. Thank you so much, Professor, for being with us. The listeners, Professor said that until the verse in this Quran, which talks about do ihsan to your parents, be good to your parents, does not condition since they have been good to you or since they have brought you properly, you do ihsan to them. The verse does not condition this. So whatever the way they have brought you, whatever the way, whatever the mistakes they have done, this is this is not a correct expectation from you that to be expecting as adult from them, they should have gone this way, they should have gone that way. Rather, you can ask from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to forgive them where they failed. Thank you so much for listening. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.